You're listening to Booth Talk from the Aftermovie Diner. And on this episode, we talk to legendary B-movie director and Roger Corman prodigy, Jim Wynorski. To start by saying thanks again ever so much for agreeing to do this. It's really great, and it'll be a nice treat for the listeners of the show, definitely.
Okay, great.
So I just wanted to ask a few questions. When you first got interested in film, was it always to make B-movies specifically? Was that always your taste?
You know, I grew up here in New York City, which is where I am now, and I was constantly loving the chiller theaters and the old Universal horror movies and the science fiction movies from the 50s that came on television in the 60s. And a lot of that fare influenced me on my way growing up.
And is that what pushed you towards Roger Corman?
Well, it's funny you should bring that up. I didn't go to see Roger Corman first off when I went to Hollywood. I thought he was unapproachable.
Right.
But I met some people who knew him, and through what I thought was a very bad circumstance, I got fired off a 20th Century Fox television show that I was working on as a location scout.
Right.
And through no fault of my own, I got the producer felt, you know, the show was floundering the ratings and they had to let people go. And he put me on a first class flight back to Los Angeles from Georgia, where they were shooting. And on that flight, I met someone who knew Roger Corman, who then introduced myself to Corman. And we had a very fortuitous first meeting, and it took off from there.
And what's it like to work with? Because you hear all sorts of conflicting stories about it, that it's both excellent and wonderful and also a bit of a nightmare. What was your personal experience with him?
You know, it's just that. It's a wonderful mess.
Right.
Roger's a very smart man, and he rides by the seat of his pants, and sometimes that can change overnight. And if you're ready for it and are aware of what may come down and not be, you know, locked into a formula, then his way of working is a very fun adventure. If you're into, you know, sometimes, you know, people get into a kind of a routine, and it was never routine working for Roger.
And is that something that you've felt that you've kept throughout your career? You like that way of working?
Yes. I mean, you have to be very malleable in the film business because it changes erratically every couple of years, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad.
Yeah.
And you have to be ready to, you know, jump without notice.
So one of the films that we're covering on the show this interview will be on is Chopping Mall, which was your second film as director, I believe.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and it's still a huge fan favorite today. So where did the idea come from for that film? What was the genesis of that?
Everybody asks me that. Here's what happened. I had made a film called Lost Empire, which Roger did not like, and it was not for him. It was for the people who owned Plitt Theaters in Los Angeles, and he didn't care for it. Even though it was shot a lot on his stages, he didn't like the movie. But his wife, Julie Corman, saw it and said, "This is fully acceptable." And she said to me, "Vestron has come to me and wants to make a movie about a killer in a mall." And I said, okay. And my writing partner, Steve Mitchell, and I talked about a whole ideas about, you know, slashers in the mall. And we were just kind of like thinking, oh, there's been so many slasher films in the last 5 years. You know, how can we make this a little novel? And I went back in my memory to a movie made in the 50s by Ivan Tours, which nobody remembers, called Gog, which was a 3D science fiction movie and about a government complex in Arizona that was built 7 levels below the ground.
Right.
And it was completely computer controlled. And into that environment were 2 robots on tank treads. And I said, okay, well, why don't we take that premise and switch it to a mall that's above ground, 4 stories above ground, and have it become suddenly computer controlled. And as it did in Gog, I think in Gog there's a Russian spaceship over the complex in orbit, and it sends down it overrides the computer and starts killing off people at the complex. Well, that's what happened. I have lightning strike our computer, and it goes off, and the robots go AWOL and insane and start tearing the place apart. And so, you know, a lot of people accuse me of taking from a movie called Trapped with James Brolin, where he and a bunch of people are trapped inside a mall with vicious guard dogs that had been on as a made-for-television movie in the mid-1970s. A film I'd seen, but I had not really thought about when I was writing Chopping Mall.
Right.
We were much more concerned with doing kind of a God thing with a computer going off the rails.
Yeah. On that film, you worked with Paul Bartel and Dick Miller, who are obviously sort of well-known people who worked for Roger at that time. Do they just come along with the sort of Roger Corman package, or did you want them specifically? Or,
well, it was my first film for Roger, you know, and I wanted to continue in the tradition of what he had done in the past.
Yeah.
So I asked Julie Corman to call Paul and Mary Warrenoff to be in it. And they ended up playing the Blands, which were for meeting Raul. And I said, that's fantastic, guys. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I also called Dick Miller, who, because I had loved him in the 50s and then the 60s with Roger, he came along and did his little bit. And no one has really noticed this, but in the background of the people that are asking questions from the audience in the mall is a guy named Rory Guy, who also goes under the name Angus Scrimm, who had been in Phantasm.
Of course, and
also Lost Empire. So he's also amongst the guest stars. But because he's in Long Shot, not many people have recognized him.
I'll have to go back and rewatch that bit then. I didn't spot him out. I'm a big Phantasm fan, but I hadn't spotted him, no.
No, he's in the movie. He asks one of the questions from the audience.
Oh, okay. I should have got that then. Are there any particular stories from the set that you'd like to share, the ones that sort of stick out in your memory?
There's so... You know, every film has stories.
Right.
Okay? And I think the big thing that we had on that show was the bad food. Okay.
Right.
That's common in a lot of movies in Hollywood of low budget, but we for some reason Julie Corman had contracted to kind of a spicy Cajun kitchen or something like that, and the food was every night was like food was it didn't know what you were eating. Sometimes we called them possum patties, and other times it was like, you know, mystery meat. And her idea of dessert was putting a little dab of whipped cream in a dentist cup. And there was nothing below the whipped cream. So you would get like a little white dentist cup
right,
with whipped cream in it. And nothing below the whipped cream. So it was just whipped cream in a dental cup. And I said, now that is what I call a dessert.
Yeah, so no one was rushing to the craft service table then on Chopping Mall.
Well, the nice thing about it is that we owned the mall for the evening. You know, once it closed at 9 o'clock, we could start shooting. And we went from 9 to 8 in the morning. And it was quite an event. because, you know, I wore my robe and slippers, and it was very comfortable, and there was nobody there. And it was rather spooky at lunchtime because he'd wander off and there would be nobody there. We had a couple of guards watching us, but other than that, it was empty as you could possibly imagine, and it had very kind of a creepy feel to it if you went off too far.
Yes, because how we arranged this interview is obviously through Barbara Crampton, who I've had on the show previously, and we talk occasionally on Twitter. And she described it as she was earning money, but all the shops were closed, so it was kind of frustrating at that time.
Right, exactly. She did a great job in the movie, and so did Kelly. And
I was going to ask you about Kelly, yeah.
Kelly and I ended up going out after that show was finished because I was, you know, she was so cute, and we just ended up going out for a little while after that. We're still very good friends, too.
Oh, that's good to know. No, I was going to ask about Barbara, obviously, because I was interested in her being in the movie. Obviously, she's one of those icons now, those scream queens that people talk about a lot. And obviously, Kelly Maroney, who you then went on to work with quite a few films after that, as well as Hard to Die, which is the other film we're covering.
Oh, my God, Hard to Die.
Yeah. we're covering Chopping Mall and Hard to Die because we'd already done Sorority House Massacre 2 on a previous episode. So I wanted to just touch on those. But, Bart, just any stories about Barbara or Kelly on the set from Chopping Mall before we move on?
You know, all I can remember is that she was very cooperative, and we had a lot of laughs on the set. And it was great camaraderie between the actors because there was, no one else to talk to and no one else to wander. It was just like if it wasn't, you weren't talking to an actor, you were talking to a crew person. And we were there for 4 weeks. And most of the time we were there after the mall was closed down. There was a theater in the mall, and we usually started to shoot before they let out. But we were shooting in all the stores, the Macy's. We were shooting in Nordstrom's, lots of record store, pet store. We were all over the place. And the only thing that wasn't really attached to the mall was the gun shop. I think we created that gun shop in an empty store. And the paint store at the end was on a set. And we built a partial of the paint store that looked out into the mall. And then when we flipped it and went the other direction, it was a set.
Right. As I said, on a previous episode, we covered Sorority House Massacre 2. How did that come about? Just because the whole inclusion of the footage from Slumber Party Massacre 1, and sort of how did that come about, and whose idea was that? And
that was a funny. I'll just tell you how it. I can tell you exactly how it happened.
Okay.
They had been shooting a movie called Slumber Party Massacre 3, I believe. Okay. On one stage. And they were also shooting Rock and Roll High School Forever on another stage.
Hmm.
So they had on one stage they had an attic and a basement, and on the other stage they had a house. And I knew that both shows were going to end shooting on a Friday, and I think it was Monday, and I went to Roger's wife, Julie, again. I said, this is, you're talking about Hard to Die. But Sorority House, that's how Sorority House Massacre kind of started, because we had these sets and I knew they were going to be coming available on the weekend. And I went to Julie Quarman and I said, I know you guys are going out of town, but, you know, why don't I shoot a movie here on these sets next week? And she said, don't tell Roger, but I'll finance it. Okay?
Yeah.
And it was going to be her movie. And she didn't want Roger to know about it. So I wrote the script, which was, an 80-page script in between Monday and Wednesday. I think I wrote like 30 pages a day. And I then gave it to Beverly Gray, the story editor, who read it and said, this is fine. And in the back of my head, I kind of knew I'm going to really feature this guy, Orville. And we were casting I think Julie and Roger left on that Wednesday to go to Europe, and on Thursday I had a huge casting session and cast the whole picture on Thursday.
Yeah.
And I even got Orville Ketchum, Peter Spellos, on Thursday. He came in. I said, "You're the guy." And the following, I think it was Sunday, I think we started shooting, and we wrapped on Friday. It was it was a 7-day. I just remember it was a 7-day shoot.
That was the first one, the Sorority House Massacre.
Yes, it was a 7-day shoot, and it had to be finished before they got back in town. And they didn't want Roger to know that it had been made.
Oh, right, okay.
And so that we shot it in 35 millimeter in 7 days.
Wow.
And I had a blast. I had a lot of fun. And the girls were sexy and fun to be with. And Peter Spellos, as Orville Ketchum, was hilarious. He was adding so much. I kept adding more stuff for him to do. And we were finished by that Saturday before they came home. And then the rumors started getting back to Roger because I think someone said something that they shouldn't have said. And he finally called me at home and said, "Did you shoot a movie last week?" And I said, "Yes, I did." He says, "Well, can I see it?" I said, "Ask your wife." Okay. And so Julie fessed up. And Roger said, "I can't believe you shot a film in a week while we were gone." I said, "Yes, I did. Can I?" And then he said, "Well, I'm coming down to the studio to watch it." So he came down to the studio and watched the rough cut. It was cut by a girl named Nina Gilberti, who's now cutting Criminal Minds.
Right.
And he called me up and he said, "You have to make the same movie for me." Okay. He says, "I love it. Make the same movie again." And he was just finishing a movie called Corporate Affairs, which left a lot of, business offices, an elevator block, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I said, "Okay, I'll do Die Hard with chicks." And he said, "I love that." Okay. So I basically called the same cast back, and both films had, because I shot them in a week, had come in rather short. So I put the same sequence from the first Slumber Party Massacre into both films.
Yeah.
And I had Peter Spellos narrate it in the first one. And then the second one, in Hard to Die, I said, "Okay, let's just make up something totally stupid for this version we were on the floor laughing when we were doing the ADR for that.
Yeah.
Because, he says, first he got Ginger, then he got Marianne, and then he faked right. And then we were having so much fun with that. And I think we even used the same piece of music that Chuck Sereno had composed both times over that sequence.
Yeah.
And, again, it was to add time. Because, you cannot make a long movie in a week. You're lucky if you could make a short movie in a week.
Right.
So we needed to have 80 plus minutes. I think we do have 80 plus minutes on those pictures. So that's why we added those that kind of like flashback.
Right, but it was already written into the story, or did you just do it later that you would reference Hochstetter? Or
no, I had planned for that sequence to go in the original script.
Right.
Because I said, I said I only have a 78, 79 page script here, so I just said, okay, he's going to tell a story here. We're going to cut to some footage that we own already. And since Slumber Party Massacre was shot non-SAG, we just chopped it up and made our own little flashback sequence.
Yeah, because it sort of weirdly now connects sort of two series of films. It sort of gives a little puzzle for people to find out, although obviously you don't use the same backstory each time. It's different from obviously.
All I can tell you is I needed to be a certain length,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't care what people thought.
Yeah. No, we love it. Like, with hindsight, it's great to kind of go back and unravel it all and look at it and sort of come up with your own reasons and stuff.
And all I knew is I had to come up with 80-plus minutes for video. And we did it.
Yeah.
And those films were like crazy moments. You know, the great thing for working with Roger Corman, one of the great things was that he left you alone. You could make almost anything as long as it was entertaining. He didn't give a real rat's ass. Okay, he just wanted films that didn't bore you, and I was pretty good at keeping him entertained. He would sit in, you know, he would sit in the screening room, and it was like torture. If you hit a dull spot in a movie, oh my God, he'd be starting to write notes in a longhand in a pad, and you know, at the end of the, right after the film, he'd say, "Cut this, cut that, cut this," and it was great when he sat there and wasn't bored. Those films were meant to be entertaining from frame one, and I had no money. On the first one we didn't even have props. We had only what was sitting in the studio, you know, prop room. They had taken all the furniture away because it was rented, and they took it all. So I came up with the idea. Okay, they're waiting for the furniture in the morning.
Right.
I mean, they're just moving into this empty sorority house, and. So we just culled whatever, you know, people brought bedrolls from home and stuff like that. We had literally nothing and lamps. We were on a set that had been just, you know, kind of just taken apart a couple of days before. And they only left the walls standing. And I had a good guy named Richard, somebody, I forgot his last name. Now it's 20 years. But he was a really good prop guy, and he would scour the lot and find whatever he could to make it look better.
Well, yeah, because you always had that. I laughed in the first one, I think, Sorority House Massacre 2, was that bit clearly where there was that moment in the film where you thought, okay, we've got to do something else, and all the girls run outside, and then you contrive for it to be raining the moment, so they're not only in their 90s, but then they get all wet. That was kind of perfect.
You know, that was intentional.
Of course,
that was intentional. I said, you know, in the script they were supposed to run outside, and it was raining, and it was just a bunch of hoses, but it worked. It did the trick. It kept them inside.
Right. But no, it was a good laugh moment as well in the best possible way.
Yeah, I think I did. In Hard to Die, I had the sprinklers go off at one point.
Yes, so exactly. That, yeah. I thought that was brilliant. I do like the fact that it's quite right, like that entertainment thing where, and it's completely maybe male and whatever, but it's fantastic that you have that thing where it's like, well, okay, we've got to contrive to get them in underwear, then we've got to contrive to get them wet, you know, then we've got to contrive to get them covered in blood, you know, or carry a machine gun. It's just, it's really great the way you put that together. It's fun. It's enjoyable.
I always throw a little, I say, you know, fuck logic.
Yeah.
Let's go have some fun. Okay. And it's quite improbable to have a gun company on the 27th floor of a right. high-rise building, but there it is.
Yeah.
And Acme Lingerie was the name of the company, and they had to go downstairs where the sprinklers went off. And I was just having fun.
Yeah.
I said, you know, I can get these people in their 90s, and I can get them wet, and then I'll get them covered with blood. And both films were very successful on home video.
Yeah.
That I can tell you. The first, even though they were not related in any sort of sense, they are, people have found them, you know, found them together and, you know, put them together as a couple. So that was nice.
Yeah. Because, the first Sorority House Massacre really has nothing to do with the other kind of two or three films in the series, so...
Is there a Sorority House Massacre 3? I don't even know. I don't think so.
No, there isn't. No, Hard to Die is called unofficially, it's one of the also known as names, is Sorority House Massacre 3.
Oh, okay, good.
And I hear it's also called... is it something 92? Nightmare 92
no,
or something?
At one point it was called Nighty Nightmare.
Nighty Nightmare, that's it, yeah.
And then in other times it was called Tower of Terror.
Yeah.
I think I have a poster from some foreign country that where all the girls are on the roof, and it's called Tower of Terror. But
But
other, it's a rose by any other name, as they say.
Of course, no, and it was it's actually clever because the whole idea of the Orville Ketchum character with he's the red herring who's beat up throughout the film, sort of poking fun at the whole idea of an undead killer, yet. Obviously, the second one you've called Hard to Die, which is obviously also a reference to Die Hard, but it's also a reference to Orville Ketchum, so it kind of all ties in.
Yeah, well, Orville Ketchum, he's indestructible.
Yeah.
I mean, in the first one, I had him shot a lot and stabbed and stuff like that, and of course, he's still alive. I'll tell you another funny story about Sorority House Massacre. It was supposed to end after Orville kills Melissa Moore, and... everybody was supposed to fall on the floor, and then they all found, kind of, except for Gail, all found dead in the morning. Okay? And, you know, I was there, and I had time during that day. I said, let's just keep this going. So even though the original script had just okay, the cops will come in. But then I said, okay, let's keep it going. Let's have Gail get up and be the new Hochstetter. And then have Pete get up and get her, and then they can shoot her, and then they can shoot Pete, and he can still be alive. And that's the way it ended, even though that was never scripted.
It's the best last line for a not scripted ending. It's the best last line when the cops come in and they go, "This one's still alive."
Call an ambulance. This man is still alive.
Such
and I think I have him come out at the end. He's in a wheelchair or something with a chick. So.
Yeah, with a large-breasted nurse who comes out of the hospital.
Yeah.
With him. Yeah.
So, you got to have fun with these movies. You have to have fun.
Yeah.
And we were hysterical when we were making it. At least I was. I was just Peter Spellis is a comedian. Okay.
Yeah.
And we were both hysterical when we make it. And when I told him, I said we're just going to go do it again. He started howling. And we did it again.
Yeah. Well, the sequel's even funnier because it the long period of time where he could call out and say to the girls, no, I'm trying to help. There's long periods where he could do that, but he just doesn't. He lumbers forward to them like a zombie and then gets killed again or stabbed again or pushed off a roof, which is tremendous.
My favorite scene, I think, in that film is when he falls off the roof, and I did an optical shake of the camera like it was a cartoon.
Yeah.
Anytime anybody falls in a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, they shake the frame.
Yeah.
I told my optical guys, when he falls off, give me a Hanna-Barbera shake. And they did, and it was like perfect.
Well, that brings up a good subject of sound effects, because the other guy I'm doing the show with, who's from another podcast, he told me that I had to ask you this question about, was it your genius idea to make the breasts, ass, and thighs squeak during both films?
Yes, of course. I said, get a balloon and squeak them, man. Just make them like they're balloons.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm a boob man. I admit it.
Of course.
But I said, I want those effects in there. I want those funny effects. And I overdid the sound effects wherever I could in those movies. I mean, I think he throws somebody down an elevator and then you hear a whistle. That's a go. when he dumps her down the elevator shaft, you actually hear a whistle. And
yeah.
I said, I want that.
Definitely.
I said, I want that, you know, cartoon sound effects. And the guy gave them to me, and they were great. And I told him, I said, make the gunshot sound real and dangerous. And he did that as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's fantastic. It sort of reaches its own, with hindsight, and of course, looking back at the films now, it kind of reaches its own level of, you know, creativity and art to a certain extent. You know what I mean? Like
I would say it reaches a new height of ridiculousness. But that's what I was going for. I didn't want this to. This wasn't real.
Right.
And Corman, when he saw when he saw Hard to Die, he was hysterical.
Good.
He said, he turned to me and said, "You've created a character." Okay. And because the fact that Orville never died, no matter how much he got shot, was something he Corman himself enjoyed.
Yeah,
because he said it. He said it's not. It's unlike anything that's come before or after. So
yeah, it's like the Michael Myers thing or the Jason thing or whatever. They're just the never ever killed. And although Orville's not a bad guy, it's kind of a parody on that, right?
Right. It is. It was supposed to be a parody of those guys that you can't kill. But the fact that he was a good guy and just slow was and looked menacing was yeah. the whole bottom line. Was like, here he is. This is obviously, but he looks like the killer. He must be the killer. Let's get him.
Yeah. And kept other people's keychains in his pants. That was the other thing he did.
Oh, I did that gag twice. That gag worked so well in the first one. I put it in the second one.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
You're gonna look, if you're going down there, you're gonna be needing this. Some of the gags, I did them twice because I said, you know, they were funny the first time. They're gonna be funny the second. Sort of like a running gag with the guy.
Definitely. And was there? I mean, did Corman ever kind of say, "Hey, why don't we make a whole like Orville Ketchum thing and like do another one?" Or
I didn't want to do another one.
Okay.
I tell you, you know, they approached me like 3 or 4 years later to do another one. And I said, you know, I said that I think the time has passed for those movies. And because in the later part of the 90s, everybody was doing these big mechanical Air Force, Navy, stealth fighter type movies. And I had to follow suit to stay in business. Okay. And I said, I don't think an Orville movie at this point is going to do anything. So
I was going to say, have you ever thought about putting the character like in other films, just in the background?
I did recently. I did an erotic film for Cinemax, and I think it was called, hold on, Sexy Wives Sensations or Sexy Wives Syndrome. And I brought Peter back to play Orville, because he still had the plaid shirt in the jean. He said he keeps it in his closet like Superman's costume. Okay, and he refused to get rid of it. So I said, put it on, come on back and do a day. So I have him. I don't say it's Orville. I just say it's just him, and he's doing something in this erotic movie. And I just did it for laughs. I think if anybody remembers those films, they're going to get a laugh when they see it. If not, he's just a weird guy in the bushes.
That's fantastic. I'll have to track that down on Cinemax then one evening just for that bit. And obviously you had Gail Harris. Like, Gail Harris is from England, I'm right, right? She's from up north. She's got some weird northern accent.
Yes. I've known Gail from the 80s.
Right.
And you can't get a cuter girl than Gail Harris back in the day.
Yeah.
Okay. And she was going through a very, I think when he did Hard to Die, she had just had a miscarriage or something like that. She was very depressed, and she was married to a guy that's long gone. And I just said, hey, Gail, come on down, be the lead here in this movie. And it was a big, it drew her out of her funk.
Yeah.
And, you know, She wears those little nighties like nobody else does. So I had Melissa Moore. I had I forgot her name. The girl who plays the bad girl in Hard to Die. She was Jack Nicholson's girlfriend for a while. Got a lot of mileage out of that. And I think I had Bridget Carney.
There's Karen Mayo Chandler.
Deborah Dutch. Deborah Dutch was in that too.
Oh, okay. Deborah Dutch. Yeah. No, they're great. They're both great films. We enjoyed them a lot watching them. And I was going to say, what was the other thing I had? Oh, yeah. So just to wrap it up then, basically, but sort of what's the favorite aspect of what you do, and what is it about making movies, no matter sort of what they are or in what conditions, that keeps you going?
Well, I like creating. I like creating, you know, creature movies, erotic movies, Western movies, kids movies, no matter what I'm doing. I'm trying to throw my own sense of humor at it, which is tougher these days because of all the restrictions that they put upon you. But I would say my erotics today are the places where I have the least confrontation with producers. I can do almost anything. And a lot of my sense of humor goes into those. Whereas my bigger sci-fi channel pictures, I have to be very, very careful about what I do. And, you know, it's always a big push-pull thing with the producers.
Yeah.
But I usually get my way. And I like what I put together. I had two movies on Sci-Fi Channel last year, Piranaconda and Camel Spiders. And I think I've got one coming up very shortly called The Giant Gila Monster. And I enjoy what I do. It's like, you know, it's like I've been doing it for 30 years and I'm not tired of it yet.
Yeah.
Because each new film is a challenge, and you get to work with some fun people, and at the end of the day, you create something that you know entertains people. Hopefully.
Yeah, because that was my last question. Is sort of, what is your feeling about the future of sort of independent and B movie productions? Because obviously, with podcasts and blogs and other websites and things like that, there's not only a fascination for the 80s and 90s video stuff. That you did and Corman did and other people, but also these sci-fi channel films, which are, you know, big on the internet. The more ludicrous the concept, you know, the giant octopus versus the mutated shark.
Well, you know, all it is, you know, Sci-Fi Channel is the drive-in of today.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, those films draw people in to watch them. And that's what they did in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. It's just a different form of delivery. And I'm going to be a part of it till, you know, I don't think the feeling will ever go away.
Yeah.
Because I enjoy what I do. I mean, Corman's in his 80s. He's still doing these things.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, because he did, what was it, Sharktopus for the Sci-Fi Channel, was it?
And yeah, he did Sharktopus, and I think later on this year I'll be doing Cobra Gator for him.
Cool.
So that's what's happening, and I'm starting another movie on the 15th of April. Actually, two movies. I'm going to do two more for HBO Cinemax.
Yeah.
And that's what's doing.
Excellent. Because do you guys in the industry, do you feel that there's sort of a boom at the moment of interest within sort of B-movies and stuff like that, or is it just business as usual? And
it's business as usual. I'll tell you what happens is every 2 years, the things flip-flop. Something changes.
Right.
Okay? I mean, there's always the harbinger of doom in the near future. And I saw it in the mid 90s. I saw it at 2001. I saw it 2007. There's always that, you know, guy says, oh, we're never going to survive. But it just seems to happen that people do survive. And the only way to survive is to keep making new films that entertain. Okay. A lot of people are making these $20,000 or less films in their backyard that never get seen by anybody except, you know, maybe at a convention. And, you know, I wish those people luck because, you know, one of them might actually do something entertaining and it would be successful. But, you know, there's competition, and I've always enjoyed competition. It gives me a chance to really just, you know, try to shine.
Yeah.
So...
Well, look, thank you ever so much for talking to us today, Jim. It's been great.
You know, give me a heads up when it's going to be on, and
sure.
I'll take a listen, because it sounds like it could be fun.
Here are just a few of the things famous people say about the After Movie Diner podcast.
Hello, I'm Dame Judi Dench, and when I'm not dusting the submarine, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast. You know, for the film reviews.
Hello, I'm Eric Stoltz, and when I'm not taking Uncle to the pictures, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the interviews.
Hello, I'm Lewis Gossett Jr., and when I'm not trampolining for peace, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the music.
Hello, Bernie Taupin here, and when I'm not undermining Venezuela, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the guests.
Hello, I'm Celia Imrie Stunt Double, and when I'm not wanking for tumours, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the comedy.
Hi there, I'm Ali Sheedy, and when I'm not taking photographs of bricks, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast, mostly for the pancakes.
Yes, that's right. The award-winning After Movie Diner podcast is all things to all people. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TalkShoe, Podbean, Facebook, Twitter, and at www.aftermoviediner.com.
There are men, and then there are second unit podcast men. The podcast you've just been listening to is part of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at 2upn.blogspot.com or on Facebook under the Second Unit Podcast Network. Our fantastic list of shows include Drunk on VHS, We Came from the Basement, No Budget Nightmares, The After Movie Diner, Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid, and Bloodbaths and Boomsticks. Take one podcast into the shower. Don't be a blithering idiot, Alan. We can give you the multiple podcast cleansing system all in one place and your hair deserves. Our programming is available across all platforms from iTunes to Podomatic, TalkShoe to Stitcher, so you have absolutely no excuse. Listen today and a free naked person of your choice will be shipped from Thailand to your door in a matter of weeks. The Second Unit Podcast Network. Bringing you the action and leaving the boring stuff to the other guys. Bloody hell. Who does a girl have to blow around here to get a decent beverage?